Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon, and we've got the Genesis team here with us again. We are excited to continue our series. This will be part three of our close reading of Genesis, especially looking at texts themselves, trying to separate the sources, the history, from the theological overlays. We'll certainly deal with both, but that's going to be our main focus of doing these close readings. Again, it's in preparation for the Gospel Doctrine year, which we're now in, and we're staying ahead of it. So I think the fact that we're going to cover today the cursing of Cain and the Tower of Babel, and then begin our good look at Abraham, puts us at least a month or 6 weeks ahead of when things like this will show up in the course. I'm thrilled to have David Bakavoy back. David, welcome back, and can you do just a quick one as far as basics and tell us about your book?
Thank you. Thank you so much. Great to be here with the Genesis team. Yay. I'm David Bakavoy. I have a PhD in Hebrew Bible in the ancient Near East. Just finished a book entitled Authoring the Old Testament. It'll eventually be a three-part series that introduces historical criticism to an LDS audience. So that should interest, hopefully, our listeners and be available in the next week or so.
Cool. And that's coming from Greg Coford Books.
Yes.
Great. Thank you so much for being back. Tom Roberts, welcome back to the show. You're our theologian, our non-Latter-day Saint. Tell us about yourself.
I'm Father Tom Roberts with a PhD in Eastern Church History and Theology. I'm Academic Dean for St. Elias Graduate School and Seminary in the PhD, where we have a research program in five languages. So we study German and Hebrew and Latin and Greek and so forth, and Aramaic and Syriac in our research program. My specialty as far as authorship is enthronements and salvation history. And I've been known as a priest who loves the Mormon Church.
Yes, so, yeah.
I'm quite happy to be here this morning with such distinctive colleagues and friends.
Thanks for being back, Tom. We love having you always. Brian Hauglid, welcome back to the podcast. This is your second time with us, and you've helped us, especially with Book of Abraham, of course, is going to be a big part of what we do today, but also background in Islam. So fill us in.
Well, my PhD is in Arabic and Islamic studies, and I teach at BYU. I'm part-time with the religion department and part-time with the Maxwell Institute now, so it kind of got me split up there a little bit. And you're right, I have done some things with the Book of Abraham, and looking forward to having a great discussion on the Abraham material today.
Yeah, there's some interesting stuff we're going to cover. Now, where we left off last time was Noah and the flood hit, the floodwaters had receded, and so basically they're on dry ground again, and we talked a little bit about the rainbow and God establishing his covenant, but we left out, just for a matter of time, the kind of controversial, or at least it's been a powerful, I'm going to go ahead and say negative, you guys can help spin it better, but a powerful passage in terms of affecting history and theology and sort of a sense of different nations and race. The section about, you know, they've planted the vineyard, Noah apparently is drunk from too much of the fruit of the vine or whatever, and his three sons. David, why don't you just take us through the text? But it's basically the cursing of Canaan stuff. So if we get you to lead us through that stuff, that'd be great.
Okay, great. I think perhaps the best way to start with that story is to backtrack to a statement that we had in Genesis chapter 5. And I'll try to cite some from the King James Version, since this is the version most of our audience listeners will be familiar with. Genesis chapter 5, we were introduced to this figure, Noah. And in verse 29, we read that his name shall be called Noah, and we are told that he shall become a comfort to humanity and provide a comfort from the work and toil of from the ground and the cursing that God had placed upon the ground, remember, which stems back to the Eden account. And this is a play upon the Hebrew name Noah and its relationship to the idea of comforting. And the fulfillment of that promise ultimately then is the story that you're alluding to, Dan, where we have in Genesis chapter 9 a reference to the fact that Noah is the first one to plant and to originate this idea of a vineyard and ultimately by extension alcoholic beverages. And it's alcohol that is going to provide, at least some extent, that comfort, that release from the toil and of the ground that humankind has been cursed to perform as a result of the fall. So that takes us then to Genesis chapter 9, where Noah plants the vineyard. He is now drunk and has this strange encounter then with his three sons, who are all survivors of this catastrophic event, the flood.
Right.
Excellent exegesis there, David.
Thank you very much. So we read in chapter 9, verse 20, that Noah began to be a husbandman, and he planted a vineyard, and he drank of the wine and was drunken and was uncovered within his tent. That's chapter 9, verses 20 and 21. And then Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father, told his two brothers without. Verse 23, Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it upon both their shoulders, and went backward and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were put backward, and they saw not their father's nakedness. Noah woke from his wine. He knew what his younger son had done and said unto him, "Cursed be Canaan, the grandson. A servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren." And he said, "Blessed be the Lord God of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant." So this story can be a bit challenging for religious readers of the text to make sense of in terms of its theology and what's happening. We have an act of some sort of sexual impropriety on the part of Ham, the son of Noah. And as a result, we read then that his son, Canaan, is cursed and that he will be a servant to Shem. And there is a clear political agenda that is being portrayed here in terms of Genesis chapter 9, a desire on the part of the author to present the Canaanites in a very negative portrayal,
right,
and to show them as sexual deviants.
Really?
Yes, this is clearly a theme that runs not only throughout Genesis but other biblical sources where the Canaanites are hypersexualized. They are presented in a way that, the authors point fun of and explain that they are inferior religiously, politically, and so forth to the Israelites themselves. So the obvious parallel for Genesis chapter 9 thematically would be Genesis chapter 19, where it's basically the same narrative, where we have a patriarchal figure, in that instance it is Lot, who participates in a sexual act with his two daughters. And as a result, we have reference to the origins of the Moabites and Ammonites, and an etymology is given to make fun of their names as sexual deviants. So these two stories seem to run together and identify a very strong political agenda that happens in Genesis to point to the indigenous population of Canaan as servants, as sexual deviants, and as people who have a questionable origin.
Huh, good. Take me back, though. So Ham just the way the text seems to be written, Ham just stumbles in and sees his dad's junk or whatever. So sexual deviancy is not really there, right? Is it more just like he maybe was thrilled by it and wants his brother to say, hey, go see it? Is that where more than the accidental part comes in?
It's very, very difficult to parse out. Scholars have taken the sexual deviance there on the part of Ham in different directions, to the extreme end of that Noah is drunk and that Ham actually rapes him. I don't know that there's strong enough evidence to take the text that far, but it's very clear that something is happening in terms of this drunken patriarchal figure, Noah, and remember, it is Lot who is drunken in Genesis chapter 9. 19,
oh,
excuse
yes,
me.
Right.
And that to some extent, then his child takes advantage of his drunken state, and there's some sort of impropriety that takes place here sexually in both accounts.
Ah, interesting. That certainly helps explain it. Now, the cursing of Canaan, why not curse Ham?
Because it points to the indigenous population of Canaan, provides an etiology then for the fact that, look, here are these Canaanites and how there's a curse placed upon them. They are inferior to the Israelites, and therefore we as Israelites deserve to occupy the land and have a superior origin racially, ethnically, and so forth to the indigenous population of Canaan.
Brian Full in here, and Tom, whatever you know from the outside sources, but when did priesthood start to come in terms of the Mormon interpretation here, and is there any precedent anywhere else that this was a cursing about priesthood, rather than just sort of what you're saying, David, here? This is all in that prehistory section of Genesis you're talking about, is where they're trying to explain the origins of a whole bunch of stuff.
Yes, precisely. So this would be the analysis that I provided thus far would be an historical critical reading, again looking for the author's agenda and purposes independent of any particular contemporary theological lens, including Mormonism. Now, within our history as Latter-day Saints, we have a very unfortunate history in terms of this story and others, where we will point to it and use a racial explanation for a priesthood ban. But as you hinted, Dan, there's really no evidence to sustain that sort of reading as something that is original or intended in the text.
Okay. Brian, do you want to either fold in some Book of Abraham here? And then Tom, is there anything outside Mormonism that goes in this priesthood direction at all? Maybe we'll go there first and then hit you, Brian.
Not so much in general Christian apologetic thinking, but one of the problems as teachers and readers of the Hebrew text that people struggle with is this Middle Eastern concept that all are righteous or all are cursed in our modern world. That seems to be grossly unfair. But in the ancient world, as all four of us are aware of, that you were either blessed or you had a covenantal curse or you had a land grant or your people were deemed as evil and under a curse, and it was all a corporate type of a curse. It wasn't looked upon as individual as much as the way we might look at things. You know, well, how could all, you know, the Canaanites be evil? But that isn't how they saw it under a covenantal curse.
Cool. So, yeah, that helps just to remind that everybody's being cursed or blessed and at this corporate level. So that's great. So, Brian, when I talk about the Book of Abraham here, I'm only going to go to the stuff in, you know, about Ham and Egyptus and all that stuff, and we'll just kind of play there because obviously the Book of Abraham begins later and where we'll pick it up when, you know, Abraham leaves Ur and all that stuff.
Sure. So just a point on Genesis here. And maybe David could weigh in on this, where the JST Genesis 9 adds another verse, verse 30. And of course, you know, we only go to 29 in the KJV here.
Oh.
And it says here, but it's actually footnoted to verse 26a, and it says, where we read, and he said, blessed be the Lord God of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant, and a veil of darkness shall cover him, that he shall be known among all men.
Wow.
David, you got a thought on that?
It's a, you know, I love the JST, the Book of Moses is an important part of that. I guess my approach to, it's important to establish, I guess, before I comment in detail, kind of my interpretation of what that is, I don't necessarily view the JST as a restoration of original authorial intent.
Right.
As more of along the lines of inspired commentary, taking the text and making sense of certain elements, bringing it into the context of the present for a Latter-day Saint audience. So with that having been said, then, I think there's great scriptural value to it, and it's establishing some inspired constructs from my perspective as a believer. Then looking at the footnote that Brian drew our attention to, 26a, yes, indeed, a veil of darkness shall cover him. It's difficult to know what the prophet intended by that. You know, probably, I don't know. I don't like the reading, but it probably does, in Joseph's 19th century worldview, tie in with other Christian interpretations of the text, which would point to this as perhaps the origin of slavery and perhaps even African slavery.
But wouldn't he say skin if he really meant skin? Because in the same way, you know, in the Book of Mormon, when you get the Lamanites becoming darker and things like that, it's not always straight up skin that he says, right? It's at least there's some room for interpretation for it to be something beyond just that.
I certainly hope so. I mean, because I certainly hope so, and that's a good point, because he does add that phrase that he shall be known among all men. How will he be known? This veil of darkness. It's, yeah, there's no reference to skin here, fortunately, but it's difficult to know exactly what's going through the prophet's mind in the production of this revision.
Cool. Brian, pick up where you left off. Sorry about that.
Well, are you interested, or maybe the listeners interested in the Islamic take on this?
Absolutely.
This is Al-Kasa'i, one of the compilers of stories about prophets and such. And here's his take on it. He says, "It is said that one day Noah came to his son and said, 'My son, I have not slept since I boarded the ark. And now I desire to sleep my fill. So saying, he put his head on Shem's lap and went to sleep. Suddenly, a gust of wind uncovered Noah's genitals. Ham laughed, but Shem jumped up and covered him. When Noah woke, he asked, 'What was the laughter?' Shem told him what had happened, and Noah grew angry with Ham. 'Do you laugh at your father's genitals?' he said. 'May God change your complexion, and may your face turn black.' And that very instant, his face did turn black. Turning to Shem, he said, 'You covered your father. May God shield you from harm in this world and have mercy on you in the next. May he make prophets and nobles of your progeny. May he make bondswomen and slaves of Ham's progeny until the day of resurrection. May he make tyrants, kings, and emperors of Japheth's progeny, and God knows best.'"
Wow, so interesting. So you have no element of drunkenness in this one.
Nope.
And just more of a laughing and a, you know, hey, that isn't funny, let's cover Dad kind of thing.
Well, Noah was a Muslim, and you don't drink.
Oh, got it.
So they had to take that out.
Well, boy, a lot of talk on genitalia, isn't it?
Yes. Well, they do get right to the point there, don't they?
Yeah.
That's for sure.
So again, we're basically sitting, whatever time all this stuff is being written, we're sitting at a time when the Canaanites are either, you know, they're either already subservient, or the authors are trying to explain why they should be.
Exactly. Yeah. That's right.
Okay.
Would you like some Book of Abraham now?
Yes. I mean, this is our opportunity to kind of just do our best to say, yeah, here's what's in the Mormon overlays, and let's do our best to make some sense of it, as well as, you know, to quote the title of the famous Armin Moss piece, "The Fading of the Pharaoh's Curse." You know,
yes.
could be, you know, we can have that conversation right in this next 10 or 15 minutes.
Actually, Dan and Brian, before we jump into the Book of Abraham, then would it be okay if I commented then on what Brian just observed in terms of the Muslim tradition?
Sure, please.
Because I think that's an important point. But, you know, our audience members are going to primarily be Latter-day Saints, and so they perhaps will feel uncomfortable to some extent with this idea of the emphasis upon Noah's drunkenness and the fact that it is through producing the vineyard and wine that ultimately he is able to provide some comfort and release from the curse that we read from the fall, that is in part fulfilled through planting the vineyard and providing alcohol to humankind, will feel uncomfortable naturally to some Latter-day Saints because of our word of wisdom. But it's important for us to remember, I believe, as Latter-day Saints, that modern revelation is not applicable anciently to religious individuals in the Bible, including Jesus himself.
Right.
So alcohol is something that, although a depressant, it does provide happiness, it provides joy, and is used that way symbolically all throughout the scriptures, which is why it's such an important symbol in the sacrament originally. It's symbolic of the blood.
It's also a precursor of paradise.
Sure.
You know, that, yeah.
Even in our Doctrine and Covenants as Latter-day Saints, Jesus says when he returns we will to the earth and cleanses it, we will drink with him from the fruit of the vine. So it's a symbol because although a depressant, it makes a person feel giddy, it makes a person feel happy, and therefore represents the type of feeling in my mind that we as Christians should feel when we partake of that sacramental ordinance, because the blood of our Savior has purified us, cleansed us. Instead of beating ourselves up over our fallen nature, we feel glad, we feel happy, we feel a sense of release that is represented through alcohol throughout the scriptures, including in the New Testament.
Interesting. That's great. That really helps. Thank
Boy,
you.
Boy, he would be a fantastic sacramentalist here. I'll have to recruit him.
So I think at least for me speaking personally, as a believer, as a Latter-day Saint, understanding that and its origins and its themes has really enhanced my own worship and experience with the sacrament ordinance, as you know, within the Latter-day Saint tradition. So, anyway, I wanted to throw that in; felt like a natural place to insert that.
Awesome.
After
Brian's explanation
comment.
Is why we use wine in the Catholic tradition, just for the very
sure.
reasons you sure. stated.
Sure, of course.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Brian, take us, just throw us into the whole priesthood stuff.
Where we kind of begin with at least connecting to Ham anyway, and I think that's where we're kind of coming
right.
from, right?
Well, that's what's in Abraham, yeah.
Yeah, so on the topic of the Pharaoh, also called the King of Egypt, it stipulates in verse 21 of chapter 1 of Abraham, now this king of Egypt was a descendant from the loins of Ham and was partaker of the blood of the Canaanites by birth. So it sounds like that he's got a blood relation here to Ham. From this descent sprang all the Egyptians. Of course, the word Egypt means forbidden.
Okay.
And thus the blood of the Canaanites was preserved in the land. So we're getting a, you know, kind of a history here of, okay, here's what happens to Ham's descendants. They find their way to Egypt here. And now we have a Pharaoh who's actually descended from Ham ruling Egypt. 23, the land of Egypt being first discovered by a woman who was the daughter of Ham and the daughter of Egyptus, which in the Chaldean signifies Egypt, which signifies that which is forbidden. When this woman discovered the land, it was underwater, who afterwards settled her sons in it, and thus from Ham sprang that race which preserved the curse in the land. So it sounds like there's a need here to explain why the curse is continuing.
But it's still no priesthood here. There's no thought of priesthood.
Yet.
Okay.
Not quite yet. And so then in verse 25, now the first government of Egypt was established by Pharaoh, the eldest son of Egyptus, the daughter of Ham. So you notice here we've got that the land of Egypt was discovered by the daughter of Ham and the daughter of Egyptus. And then the daughter of Ham here is named Egyptus. We've got two Egyptuses here
okay.
going on.
All right.
And by the way, in my research with the textual history of the Book of Abraham that I did, I found that in the manuscripts that, and I right now I can't recall which one of the Egyptuses this referred to, but one of the Egyptuses was referred to as Zepta, Zeptah. And the other one was referred to as Egyptus. So there was only one Egyptus in the manuscripts.
Okay.
And then the other one was Zepta. And I have no idea how the other one got Egyptus instead of Zepta. But that's what happened. So it's in 26 where you start getting tied in a little bit more to the priesthood. With Pharaoh being a righteous man, established his kingdom, judged his people wisely, justly all his days, seeking earnestly to imitate that order established by the fathers in the first generation in the days of the first patriarchal reign. So that order, of course, is we're getting closer to actually saying the priesthood. So this is of the first patriarchal reign, the reign of Adam, and also Noah, his father, who blessed him in blessings of earth, the blessings of wisdom, but cursed him as pertaining to the priesthood. All right? So here we have a direct reference to the descendants of Ham being cursed as pertaining to the priesthood, and the Pharaoh being of that lineage by which he could not have the right of priesthood, notwithstanding the Pharaohs would fain claim it from Noah, imitating it apparently through Ham. Therefore, my father was led away by their idolatry, which is a whole other topic there. But you can see where you're getting the connection to the priesthood through the loins of Ham, all the way to the Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. And it's all related to Ham. What happened back, I guess, going back to that occasion, perhaps, in Genesis 9. And are we getting that here, Genesis 9, in any of the footnotes? I don't see any of the footnotes here to Genesis 9, but so...
Okay, so let me ask, maybe I hope I'm not going to mess with the train of thought. Okay, so now we're starting to get the priesthood in here, but only your Muslim source, your Islamic source, did we even get skin, you know,
exactly.
black. So it, somehow or other, when the Mormon scholars and stuff started to reinterpret this stuff, that's where they were able to pull it apart and say they're pulling apart. Not that the Pharaoh didn't have the right to priesthood, but they started to put that more towards because it was a matrilineal thing versus a patriarchal right. But mm-hmm. but they were able to start pull this apart from skin color.
Yes, absolutely. That's what's going on, I think. Yeah, you don't get a mention of black skin here in Abraham. You do have a little bit of that in Moses, the book of Moses, you probably recall.
Oh, that's right.
But you don't really have it here in Abraham. It is focusing primarily on priesthood.
Yeah, and the whole first book, the whole first chapter of Abraham is Abraham talking about how I've been seeking my entire life to be in this generation of people, you know, the receiving the priesthood that goes back to the beginning of time, and so he's clearly, this whole chapter, he's focused on priesthood, isn't he?
Yeah, and it's interesting that Genesis itself, in relation to Abraham, and I think anybody else in there is no mention of priesthood, and of course chapter 1 of Abraham is not attested really in Genesis at all. You start getting to some Genesis material in chapter 2 of the book of Abraham, but not chapter 1 at all. And so, as you know, Abraham, the book of Abraham is just filled with these priesthood ideas that Genesis is completely lacking. There's nothing there as pertaining to priesthood. Even with the Ham, there's nothing with priesthood.
Okay, Tom. Just in case there is something here, is there side traditions, you know, besides Genesis, but that have showed up in these the wider material that relates to priesthood at this point, or is basically the Book of Abraham that the Mormons have the only one that really even plays with priesthood at all in this time period?
It is interesting. There is some typology in the Genesis Apocryphon and others that some of the rabbis kind of go back to Shem and try to, you know, say that like Abraham, you know, he's the father of the Semitic peoples and all of this. But outside of some typology, there isn't very much.
Thanks. Okay, so now Brian and David, however you guys just go, help Latter-day Saints today kind of understand the history of the deconstruction of these ideas to where, you know, Lester Bush and everybody was able to convince enough folks that there really isn't any scriptural stuff here that would preclude blacks from holding the priesthood.
Not that I can see in the Book of Abraham, there's not anything. What looks like happened is
I think you did a, you just did a podcast not too long ago on the race and the priesthood, that the statement that was put out. And I think in that podcast, in fact, I listened to some of that podcast, and it looked like the, what was being said was that that interpretation, the interpretation of what happened with Ham and the curse of Ham and this kind of thing was something that was developing or had developed up until the 19th century. And it was a very strong presence by the time of Joseph Smith. There's a good book, by the way, called The Curse of Ham, Race and Slavery in Early Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, that you might know about, with Michael Cook and Gold. And that, you know, we get a sense of how some of these ideas emerge over the years and how powerful they are by the 19th century. And it's powerful enough that it takes a long time for those ideas to be questioned, I think. The questions that they asked back in those days are so different than the questions that we ask today about race and priesthood and these kinds of things. But we have to acknowledge, just as President Uchtdorf did, that people, that prophets are people, and they're products of their time, just like we're products of our time, and that as Latter-day Saints, we try to understand the best that we can inspiration and revelation within the context of the time that we're living in, but we're not always absolutely accurate or right about those things. And that's what, and I think you're seeing that happen with this whole race in the priesthood coming up here. And so my guess is that when Elder McConkie went through and started studying up on the on this issue in the scriptures and came back to President Kimball and said, look, I can't really find any actual support for denying blacks the priesthood. You know, I think that was a very big turning point right then and there that, okay, we've really got to rethink this here.
Right. You know, really? But Bush had predated McConkie's look. So, but McConkie was basically confirming through his own brain and study sort of the hints that that had already begun here. But yeah, I'm with you 100% in that article from Ed Kimball when he talks about his father's wrestle to do this. I know that Elder McConkie is like, yeah, I'm not seeing anything scripturally. That was a big point.
And it's wonderful that Lester Bush did that article, and I think it keyed McConkie into some of these things, but it's when you get up to those higher levels that you're really going to start getting some change anyway, even though maybe some of what Lester Bush said was instrumental in helping that happen.
I think he helped seed the question.
Yeah.
David, go broader than this, but I'm guessing that somewhere along the line in somebody's Sunday school class, we're going to get to the flood, we're going to get to this end section, and somebody's going to make the connection there with this Ham and cursing of Canaan and priesthood. What prepare somebody to basically say, that doesn't seem to be in the scripture, and maybe how you'd handle that?
Well, I suppose the first thing I would do is draw attention to the church's recent release on racism, and which documents and discusses the fact that we now disavow racist theories of the past. And then I would explain, as we've already done and as Brian has shared with us, that there's really no evidence in the Book of Abraham or specifically in Genesis that points towards that direction. And then I would take them and discuss the political nature of this account to present the Canaanites as deviants, as inferior to the Israelite population. And I would talk about that in terms of historical critical analysis, at least briefly, even in a Sunday school or seminary context, if you will. Because I think it's important that we recognize as Latter-day Saints that critical thinking and critical analysis, whether we're talking scripture or our history as Latter-day Saints, or even ideas and theories that are presented by those whom we sustain as prophets, seers, and revelators, is an essential component to spiritual development and growth. Just because something is said in the scriptures or by someone who holds a priesthood office doesn't mean that we as individuals have to automatically accept that as the mind, will, and and so forth of God. In reality, we are still held responsible as individuals, truth seekers within Mormonism, to work things out intellectually and spiritually. And I think that's an important part of our spiritual growth. So we certainly see that as in terms of the racist interpretations that are part of our history as Latter-day Saints. But it's been disavowed. And I am so grateful now as a Latter-day Saint to live in a time period where we are looking critically, not only at our history, but also at the scriptures and saying, you know, let's understand how these people interpreted these texts. Let's understand what the original authors meant. But that doesn't, that understanding with that, then we're able to pick and choose, so to speak, as to what we believe is actual reality, not only in terms of history, but also in terms of our relationship to divinity and his views on the plan of salvation and humankind.
Right. Can I just say that, add to that, David, with your thoughts about, you know, critical thinking, that's exactly what I think happened with the Book of Abraham. Here we're looking at the Book of Abraham. We are seeing that something's happening with the priesthood. But when you really look at it, there's absolutely no connection to African Americans there. there's no connection to black skin. There's nothing there that supports that. And so we do have this connection to some sort of a priesthood restriction. We're seeing that, but making the assumption that it's tied to African Americans is to me a big leap there. You're just not getting that in the text. And so that's why I think it's so good what you're saying there about let's be careful and let's be critical in our thinking about what we're reading here. And I think that's what I think Brother McConkie finally came to understand, and with the help of Lester Bush and others. And so does that make sense, Dan?
Totally, yes. Now, I just wanted to do one more quick thing. David, would you ever like tell people – again, it's kind of come up just in passing here, you know, the author of Genesis in this case, and then again, if you say if the Book of Abraham really is the writings or the, you know, the views of Abraham, these guys have an agenda of our people are the favored ones, these are the less favored ones, we want their land. And so, you know, Abraham wouldn't deconstruct anything that he would have, you know, sort of had in the air, just as our prophets we're talking about didn't deconstruct curse of Cain and all that kind of stuff in there. I think I botched that, but basically it's sort of like Abraham as a character would have breathed the same air that the author of Genesis here is breathing, and basically saying we're the best, we're the right people to occupy this land, and these guys are inferior.
Sure, I'd feel comfortable in explaining that in a devotional context. I think there's great value to that. We even, Dan, see that in our Book of Mormon, not to get it too far off track.
No, but I do. Yes, I wanted to bring that next.
Yeah, there definitely are instances where Nephite authors, at least from my perspective, present a racial stereotype of what it means to be a Lamanite. They're mighty hunters. They have dark skin. They're unfavored of God. And then this stands in contrast, and it's so beautiful, when Jesus steps forward in 3 Nephi and says, well, what about the writings of Samuel the Lamanite? And really, in a sense, is kind of calling them to repentance for ignoring the, you know, what ultimately came to them from a source that most Nephite people or authors tend to view as inferior racially. So awesome. I think there's great value, even in a devotional context, of recognizing that an author can be inspired, a current priesthood leader can be inspired, and yet still be influenced by his cultural biases, and yes, which oftentimes include racist feelings.
Yes, and so it's interesting, if you think of Mormon as an abridger of records, he, you know, and we don't really know where he's at, you know, except at the end of his life, and he's obviously at war with Lamanites and things like that, so he wouldn't deconstruct it. But yet there's these parts that he must come to where it's almost like the best marriages we see in the entire Book of Mormon are these Lamanite marriages with Lamoni and his wife and Lamoni's father and his wife, where there's you know, all the wild and ferocious and untamed and, you know, unredeemable people, and yet you have the most loving relationships portrayed there.
Yeah, that's an excellent observation. And I think it goes to show exactly what we're talking about, that Even inspired authors, prophets, seers, and revelators are still products of their time period.
Yeah. Okay, are you guys, are we done with this Curse of Canaan business? Is there anything else anybody has? Otherwise, we'll move on to the Tower of Babel.
Let's move on.
Well, do you guys want to do anything about that genealogical chapter, chapter 10?
I can make a brief comment on that.
Please do.
As we as readers of Genesis then transition from Genesis 9 into chapter 10, this is a section that is known technically as the Table of Nations. It's a long genealogical list. I think one of the most interesting things to point out is the reference to Nimrod as a mighty hunter in verse 9. This Table of Nations, through Nimrod and the other individuals that are referred to, again ties back to this theme that we discussed in previous podcasts of the influence that Mesopotamia has on the book of Genesis. So what we find in these stories is that, well, for example, Nimrod, the mighty hunter, is probably an allusion to the Mesopotamian king Naram-Sin, who is the grandson of a famous figure by the name of Sargon. Sargon is the founder of the dynasty of Akkad, which appears listed in this biblical table of nations in Genesis 10 as a god. So my main point in drawing our attention to this is just simply that this prepares us for Genesis chapter 11, which is going to focus explicitly on Babylonian worship and through the Tower of Babel, but again highlights the fact that without Babel, as we said previously, there would be no Bible.
Rabbis have also stated, too, that 70 is symbolic of all the nations in that part of the world, and therefore it would be all important peoples, you know, like God ate and drank with 70 elders. All that are supposed to be there are listed. You know, it's also true in Canaanite tradition, Asherah had 70 sons for 70 nations, too.
Is this more David-like, what we've done before, is just these writers along the... Because you're saying this is still in the prehistory section. They're just basically trying to note everything that's happening around them, just sort of explain relationships and whatnot, but there's no, like, they're not claiming that God was behind, you know, these nations shaping the way they are and things like that, right?
Well, I do think they believe that God is behind the development and shaping of nations to some extent, but it depends on which source and tradition. Specifically in 10, I don't know that we can go that far, perhaps, but we do find that same sort of theme that you're referring to in Deuteronomy chapter 32, verses 8 through 9, where, you know, God is going to, you know, divide up humankind and assign specific divinities, ultimately from the divine council, to rule and reign over the various nations and groups and peoples of the world. So my purpose in emphasizing then the Mesopotamian connection with chapter 10 is because thematically this will prepare us for chapter 11 with this emphasis on Babylonian worship through the Tower of Babel.
Well, let's go there, because this is a weird story. But again, it fits to me, again, and I'll just say it ahead of time, and you could totally make me wrong, and that's just fine. It just is, again, they're just trying to explain why there's so dang many languages here. And the rest of it is just weird to me, and it's just stuff I just can't take seriously. So help me, help us the story, maybe as the writer was saying it, David, and then we can all comment.
So this story is just a wonderful tradition and example of what the Yahwist is doing in terms of this theme of the conflict between humankind and God. To Jay, the author of this account, God intended for humans to live in a state of dependence and reliance. We could even use the term impotence, if right, you will, in nature. They're ownerless. They are nomads. And this is all throughout this source because God is threatened. Yahweh is threatened because the humans are so he is so anthropomorphic, and they are therefore by extension so very much like him that he's concerned about the boundaries and keeping them in this state of dependence. And humans, in the course of Jay's narrative, find this state of vulnerability intolerable. They're always seeking self-expression and safety. They do not want to be at the mercy of God or nature. And this, Dan, then, is the very theme theme of the story of the Tower of Babel. It's the conflict of nature and culture. And I think that's a good way to understand the narrative from this angle. So basically what happens is that in this story, we find that men migrate from the east, apparently for the purpose to spread over the earth, and they come to something called the Plain of Shinar and recognize that although God, Yahweh, wishes them to spread over the earth, they would be vulnerable if they did this. They would be powerless. So they stop in the dispersal process and proceed to build a city. And from my perspective, therefore, the account is they're not trying really to vie with God, nor are they trying even to, as is traditionally interpreted, to necessarily reach the heavens. But really, they're seeking self-expression and ultimately self-preservation. We see this, for example, in chapter 11, verse 4, where we read, they said, go to, let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven, and let us make us a name, lest we be scattered or dispersed abroad upon the face of the whole earth. They do not want to be in a state of vulnerability because, right, of course, you know, historically, people have greater power if they are brought together in a group, if they build cities, if they do the types of things that bring people together for protection. And when they say, let us build ourselves a city and tower, they're not seeking, Dan, from my perspective, to reach the heavens. They're simply talking in terms drawn from Babylonian city structure and architecture. I believe they're seeking to build for themselves a base from which they can create and accomplish and prevent their power from being dissipated. Again, the King James uses the term scattered, and therefore their numbers dispersed.
Now, isn't there at least something, though, that they want to build something really tall in case the floods were to come again, it wouldn't be able to at least go. So if they're not going to try to get all the way to heaven, they're at least going to try to be to higher than the floods?
Well, it's often interpreted that way, but there's really no textual evidence that that is the objective. There's really no reference to the flood. In fact, if we recall previously, God, if we read Genesis synchronically, meaning taking it holistically as it stands, remember that God has promised that he'll never flood the earth
again.
So they don't need to worry about it.
Okay, but do they, you know, but they might just say, oh, maybe that was a mistake. That, in other words, let's hedge our bets. You don't think that's going on either?
I don't think that's happening in the text, but I have quite frequently heard it interpreted as such in an LDS context, in Sunday schools and other places. So I'm glad that you brought that up, but I don't see that here. Ultimately, what we see is let's receive fame. Let's build a name for ourselves. Let's avoid scattering. We do not want to scatter. We do not want to be dispersed. And it reflects Babylonian city structure and architecture and the desire for safety. It's the same theme that we saw earlier in J, where humans do not want to be vulnerable, and God wants to keep them vulnerable and therefore dependent upon him.
So when we get into this section where, like, man, look at what they can do together. I can't have them cooperating so much. This is Yahweh basically saying, I promise I won't destroy them, but now I'm going to, like, at least make it harder for them to do this cooperative work where they need me less.
Precisely. That's precisely correct. Their desire to make a name for themselves, lest they are scattered over the world, it does not suggest that they are rebelling against God. To use a term, but they are attempting to protect themselves, at least rebelling from their perspective. Right now, God sees it as an act of rebellion, but they are attempting simply to protect themselves, to use power in a very creative way. And God views this as a threat. And so he comes down and he chooses to scatter the human race.
But, okay, so when did the language, so he chooses to scatter the human race by basically making them not be able to talk to each other, so they're going to say, what's the point of us hanging together? No?
Excellent. So Jay's documentary source contains this story that is very interested in Mesopotamian technology and, by extension, languages. The account depicts the way in which the famous Mesopotamian city, Babylon, received its name by playing upon the Akkadian words Bab Elu, which is their name for Babylon, and it technically means gate of God. The proper name Babel seems to be a mixture of two separate Semitic languages. The Akkadian word bob, meaning gate, and the Hebrew word el, which is ultimately a play upon Akkadian il, meaning God. Remember, the name for Babylon is in Akkadian. Their language is bab ilu, gate of God, and el means God. So what we have through this account is the J source provides a Hebrew explanation for the name Babylon as a literal confounding of two languages. Because, yes, because Yahweh confounded or babbled, if you will, human language through this process. And in so doing, I would argue, creates from his perspective a case of even greater vulnerability, because now they cannot unite themselves because they all speak different languages. So here you have, again, Jay's emphasis and interest in stories of etiology, stories of origin, emerging in the text. Let us explain why there are so many different languages in the world today. Well, it ties into the greater themes that the Yahwist wants to explore from a mythological perspective.
Tom, throw anything in from the wider tradition, then Brian, if there's anything in Islam on this stuff. So Tom first.
No, not a whole lot, other than just what I said on the 70 language, even from Asherah. There does seem to be, as we move through Genesis, a wider circumference beginning here, especially as we move through chapter 11, where the descendants of, you know, Shem are broadened, and Genesis 14:20, you know, where there is honor given to Shem, and we see the blessings of other Semitic peoples beginning in Genesis 16, you know, with the 12 princes and so forth, and it all seems to go back to the area that we're migrating through now. We also see a lot of emphasis put on firstborn, not only Shem, but Eber, Peleg, Reu, you know, Serug, you know, Nahor, and Terah become very interesting people, like, you know, and the things they do, they're actually living out what their names are, which show us that names are extremely important in the Semitic mindset, and the role they play in the saga as more players are introduced into the narrative and plot.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay, let me pick up then, Dan, on what Tom said, because I loved his explanation there and the reference to the name, and it's very helpful from my perspective as readers. If we approach Genesis scene chronically, meaning reading it holistically as it stands, there is a correlation between Genesis 11 and Genesis 12 in terms of name, because in Genesis chapter 11, the people of Babel want to make a name for themselves and avoid scattering. They build a tower that Yahweh finds threatening, which stands in direct contrast to Abraham. In chapter 12, where we read God's first command to Abram, in verse 1, get thee out of thy country, from thy kindred, from thy father's house, unto a land that I will show thee, ultimately a command to scatter. And then in verse 2, he states, and I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great. So he accepts scattering, and in the process, he receives a great name. Now remember, and then ultimately in chapter 12, we'll see Abram build a tower, an altar, if you will, that is accepted by Yahweh. So there is a direct contrast between that is made here synchronically between Abram, who receives a name, who accepts scattering, who builds a tower/altar, versus the people of Babel in the previous chapter in 11, who want the name, who refuse to scatter and become vulnerable, and who build this tower that Yahweh, instead of accepting, finds threatening.
Wonderful. Brian, throw in either Islamic stuff or just anything else you'd want to say.
Well, that's really interesting comments that David is making there, because the Muslims, they put the tower actually in Abraham's day. So it doesn't quite follow the synchronicity of Genesis there. And it's under, it's really, Nimrod seems to be the protagonist in all that. Nimrod is a very popular character in Islamic literature, as opposed to Genesis here, where he's just basically called a hunter, and there's not a whole lot there. He's got a very prominent role, especially with Abraham. He's the antithesis of everything Abraham's about. He rules a wicked kingdom with polytheistic, religious, idolatrous practices, all the very corrupt, all this kind of thing. And so there's a big battle that goes on between Nimrod and Abraham in this literature. And at one point, Nimrod, he says to Abraham, if what Abraham says is true about his Lord, I shall not rest until I know who resides in heaven. So Nimrod builds this tall tower in Babylon, desiring to climb into it, to climb from it into heaven in order to look at the God of Abraham as he imagined. So there's nothing about language yet, nothing. It's all about Nimrod here. And so Nimrod then he takes these four eagle fledgling, he raises them until they're mature, he ties a wooden chest to their feet, and then puts a stick on top of the wooden chest that has some raw meat on it, so it's out in front of the eagles, and he puts a boy inside the chest, and it has a door on the top and a door on the bottom, and then he lets the eagles go. And of course, the eagles are chasing this meat. That's what they want. And
right.
So they're going higher and higher into the air there, hoping to get to heaven. And at one point, the lad opens the top window and notices sky, notices the bottom window, notices earth. And then Nimrod says, when you get as high as you can, shoot an arrow into the air. And so he does that. He shoots an arrow into the air, and it comes back stained with blood. And Nimrod says, now I have been spared my preoccupation with the God of heaven.
he can be wounded. So he's nobody to worry about. Okay.
But unfortunately, that comes back at him a little bit later, where God sends a wind that flung the top of Abraham's tower into the sea. The rest of the building then collapsed and fell down on them, knocking over their houses. Nimrod was gripped by a shudder when the tower fell, and because of the fear, the tongues of the people became confused, and they spoke in 73 languages. Therefore, the place was named Babel, because the languages became confused. So there's the
awesome
Islamic take on that.
Interesting. Well, I'd heard some of that stuff before about the Nimrod things. It's probably just from a long time ago reading Nibley. But
yeah,
I didn't realize that was mostly purely Islamic sources. And so, Tom, there was nothing besides what you get in Islam there. Was any of that Nimrod stuff familiar to you in the wider reading that didn't come from Muslim writings?
That is true. There does seem to be redating in some of the Muslim sources of events in the Old Testament, isn't there?
Making Abraham and Nimrod a contemporary, is that what you mean?
Exactly, yeah. And some other events in Islamic commentaries do lend itself to redating.
Interesting. Well, this world is just so fascinating that we're diving into here, guys. So, thank you. Well, anything more on Tower of Babel? My summary is, or at least my takeaway is, they're just trying to explain. Well, one of the things they're trying to explain is why there are so many different languages, and this idea that God all of a sudden would make a basic unified language, you know, go into a whole bunch of different ones all in some, you know, fell stroke. That just seems to me to be myth-making in terms of the stuff that they can believe goes on back then, but I don't feel any compulsion to think that there was a time where they were all of a sudden changed, right? Anybody else? Anyone argue with that? Okay,
well,
please.
You know, sometimes you hear in LDS circles the explanation that's not really, I don't think, brought out in the text at all. That, you know, the original language was Adamic, and people became wicked. And so, you know, part of losing the Adamic language was because of a result of sin and moving away from God further and further, and therefore, you know, the languages get corrupted, and that's why you have the development of many languages, is because you're moving further and further away from Adamic and God and these kinds of things. And of course, again, that none of that is really textually supported at all. I'm not sure where even all that comes from, but
Joseph himself is interested in restoring the Adamic language, and has, you know, this idea of getting back to a pure language that can be reconstructed through inspiration and through inspired translation. So, I mean, to some extent, we can trace those. I think directly we can trace those the ideas back to the prophet.
Yeah,
isn't it interesting in Zephaniah, you know, where it may be referring to the Messianic age, most of the Hebrew rabbis tend to say, well, we're going to get to a pure language or a clean language without cognates that have been added to the Semitic roots. I find that very, very interesting. We just can't keep ourselves out of anything. I'd love to hear the panel's view of when we work our way through some of the Hebrew and some of the Akkadian, especially referring to Abraham, where it means to love, for example, also means to be exalted. And there are some issues there from the word Ramu in the Akkadian, that if a person is loved, they're revered, they're exalted. Even just basic things like that do not come through always in our English text to let us know that these key people being addressed here are greatly revered for good or evil.
I think it's a fascinating observation, and as Tom was speaking, I was reminded of the fact that, you know, any translation is an interpretation, and it's important for us as Latter-day Saints to be aware of that as we approach seriously the Bible and try to interpret it in its original context historically. Tom was referring to Akkadian and its connections with, with Hebrew. Boy, we talked about this earlier in previous broadcasts, the connection between Tahom, or as it's translated as deep, in Genesis chapter 1, and Tiamat, primordial mother goddess, who is represented in Marduk's story of Enuma Elish. So what I guess I would take from that would be the idea that although I've been citing from the King James Version of the Bible, that is an interpretation of the language that is there in the text, and we should be. I would just encourage our audience members, I suppose, to take advantage of other more recent translations of the Bible to try and get back to some of the ideas linguistically reflected, especially in study Bibles. Well, things like that Tom referred to will be drawn out for them.
Cool. Ready to move on, or any last comments with anybody on Tower of Babel?
Yeah, Dan, just a couple more thoughts I think that perhaps we could emphasize for our listeners. There is perhaps something happening here in terms of the story in regards to a type of taunt regarding Babylonian arrogance. And that, if our listeners will, you know, start to explore scholarly writings on this material, they'll inevitably come across that sort of interpretation. And so this is an interesting thing to draw out. We can link the story with Isaiah 14, 13 through 14, where you have a similar type of taunt that is given in the book of Isaiah of someone, but this time it's a little bit more explicit in terms of the ascension into heaven motif that I don't think is fully developed in the Tower of Babel story as we have it. But nonetheless, our listeners will immediately recognize that there's a direct correspondence between the accounts. I'll read the King James Version.
Okay.
For thou hast said in thine heart, and we interpret this as Satan, but it seems to point to an Assyrian king in its historical context, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. So we can link this with the idea that the builders of Babel want to construct a city and tower that will reach unto heaven. So in this sense, the builder's pride reflects the boasting of the Babylonian king that we find hinted towards in the book of Isaiah. And so again, I think thematically this connects the text, suggesting that there's a type of taunt regarding Babylonian arrogance. It's as if the authors are highly impressed with the advanced technological achievements of Babylonian culture to build a city. And yet they have the sense of that there's a grave danger that comes with it as well, at least from God's perspective, that we will not truly reverence him and do what is ultimately his will. And Dan, in recent years, some scholars have read this account and interpreted it in a very interesting way from my perspective. They've read the city and tower as symbols of foreign dominion and oppression. And what I mean by this is that they view it in light of the political relationship between Babylon and Israel. And therefore, the story pokes fun at the ziggurat of Babylonian tradition by playing upon the name Babel. And when interpreted from this angle, rather than a punishment per se, the confusion of languages might ultimately represent a type of political liberation. So liberation from Babylonian oppression and their arrogance.
Wow.
Following this short political allegiance with Egypt, if we consider historically at the time the Yahwist is writing, the kingdoms of Judah and its capital city of Jerusalem came directly under Babylonian control around 605 BC. And Judah's capital city never fully accepted this vassal relationship that it had with Babylon. And so although the scribes who produce these accounts in Genesis are directly influenced by Mesopotamian traditions, they're in the one hand, they're completely impressed with the technology, the traditions, the myths. But on the other hand, of course, they're striving for political independence, for religious autonomy. And together with other communities in this region of the world, Jerusalem ultimately will lead an unsuccessful revolt against Babylon in 599. So this desire to, I don't know, it's ultimately, if we link this with the historical events that we can identify, because of course the Tower of Babel is prehistory. It's something that we can't verify as something that actually took place, but things that archaeologically make sense to us in terms of Judean revolt and their rejection of Babylon, the diversion of language, the dispersal could be a type of political liberation and independence from this perspective. And if that reading is correct, then I think it's fascinating to connect that thematically with what we find in terms of the Doctrine and Covenants section 1, verse 24, from a religious perspective, the idea that God speaks to people according to their language and so that they might come to an understanding. And this ultimately would connect thematically then with the idea of the revelatory process and how God must speak it to us in accordance with our language as opposed to the language of someone else. So that's how I would provide perhaps a religious or theological spin for a Latter-day Saint audience on ultimately, this text that is connected with pre-origins and a desire to create and explain etiologically the development of different languages and perhaps even present a taunt against Babylonian arrogance.
Man, such interesting stuff. Thank you.
But can I kind of go back to the language thing for just a moment?
Sure.
As we're kind of finishing that up, maybe go back to the 19th, 20th century just for a second here. I've done a lot of work on the Egyptian papers that Joseph Smith and W.W. Phelps and some of those earlier people put together in 1835. And there is definitely a clear reference to language there in terms of a pure language or some pristine language. What I haven't been able to connect yet is anything that they're doing there. They connect it to Ham. They connect it to, the Book of Abraham. And that kind of thing, but they don't ever really connect it to Genesis or especially the Tower of Babel. I haven't seen really any connections there. And so the development of this whole idea of pure language, and how it relates to the multiplicity of languages. I haven't yet found that. And so that's why I said, look, it's interesting that you have this whole idea of Latter-day Saints trying to explain, you know, this pure language and how it was with the brother of Jared and the Tower of Babel. And then it kind of gets corrupted after that, kind of paralleling the corruption of mankind kind of an idea. But I haven't really, I've got the pure language back in Joseph Smith's day, no problem there, but I've not got really much connection with these documents that I'm working with anyway, or maybe even a few others with the Tower of Babel. Have you seen anything with that, David?
No, not specifically, but I think perhaps we should draw our listeners' attention to a very helpful article. That I know Brian's familiar with it. Samuel Brown wrote.
Yeah, Sam Brown.
Joseph Smith in Egypt, Babel, hieroglyphs and the pure language of Eden. Right,
if I remember
the title of that.
Yeah.
And it was. Let's see, where was that published, Brian?
I think it was in Christian History. Was it, if I remember?
Oh, the church. It's in church,
church history.
History. That's,
church
that's
history. That's
church
it.
History. That's at 2009.
Yes, and he does a great job of showing the cultural environment of a pure language there. He does great with that.
He does.
I'd love to read it. Sounds fascinating, gentlemen.
Maybe Dan could.
Yeah, I'll see if there's a live link to it, or if that's protected by the journal. We'll have to see. Yeah, but I remember, and if nothing else, I know that he spoke on it a few times at Sunstone, so we could probably at least find some Sunstone presentations of that. Yeah, when he was working through that material he was presenting.
One of the things that I would add is from a later theological frame that we can take back to Isaiah 14 and the writings of Ezekiel is a lot of Old Testament casual readers are so quick to put Hasatan, in ideas, that are really talked about, ancient leaders. And unfortunately, that came to the church through the auspices of Jerome, rather than is this the man who, brought down the nations and in Ezekiel 28, Isaiah 14, where the light bringer in Babylonian mythology in this case would be shown every March when the liturgical calendar, would come around and make the light bringer, very, very well illuminated. And we have to understand how these, in the Old Testament sense, are used as literary types where Zion becomes, out of this, a place or a mountain that is righteous, and Babel, goes into Babylon, becomes the political oppressors of the people. And these marvelous literary forms are developed throughout Scripture, and we see a lot of the typologies begin here.
Very interesting. And for those who didn't pick it up, the light bringer, Lucifer, right? Lucifer is what you're referring
right,
to there.
Right. Yeah. And if we were reading the Hebrew Bible in ancient times, we would never connect that to Hasatan, who would be the angel of death in the Mishnah in later Jewish writings. So but we need to be very careful that we don't read our contemporary theology back into it just because, we see a phrase we think we understand.
Right. Good stuff. And Jerome, Jerome's influence came through what? That you said it was
He was writing commentaries not only on Psalms but all of the Old Testament text. And so he would look at this from a more dualistic perspective and just simply say, well, it's either good or evil, And so when they'd read, this leader from Tyre or a Babylonian type of, you know, God. They would just read that, well, that's impersonations of Satan, you know, and that's how they justified that, their particular reading.
Thanks, Tom. Brian, you brought up something that it was in my notes to bring up a little bit here, and that was the mention of the Brother of Jared and the Jaredites and the Tower of Babel sort of being in the Book of Mormon. The Book of Mormon is sort of committing in some ways to the literal, the interpretation here that God confounded language all of a sudden. So this brother says, please don't confuse my family, you know, because of my righteousness. Bless us on that one. And we have that playing out here. Do we need to keep pursuing that? Because if so, I can throw into it.
And the Brother of Jared, of course, in the Book of Mormon, it does refer to him as speaking the pure language, does it not? I can't recall exactly. And so maybe that's where we're getting a connection to the Tower of Babel there, with the pure language being corrupted. I don't know. It's not right at the top of my head.
Yeah. I mean, I am interested in how you guys, again, would this be a sort of a situation of, yeah, the Book of Mormon says that, and you could just say, well, Mormon and these guys who are working, or, you know, who are working with it wouldn't have had, this is all in the mythology of their own backgrounds, and so they don't doubt it, but it doesn't mean that we have to literally believe that it was, you know, confused by God in the manner that they believed it was.
I think that's a great way of one possible of a way of interpreting the Book of Mormon, Dan, that you've just expressed. We don't need to, just because I think sometimes we assume that because the Book of Mormon presents a story that it is therefore historical.
Right.
We need to, in the same way that we're open to the idea that the authors in the Hebrew Bible are influenced by mythology, the Book of Mormon has to be allowed for that same sort of influence. So I, you know, especially when read from a critical perspective, from a believing Latter-day Saint perspective, in the sense that it, you know, it's an ancient text. Well, if it's an ancient text, then we ought to allow it to function as an ancient text, which means that there will be mythology and the biases of its various narrators.
Yeah, that works.
You know, okay. It does say here in Ether that this is a part of the account I give. This is Moroni talking, from the tower down until they were destroyed. And then it says in Ether 133 that Jared came forth, his brothers, their families, some others and their families, from the great tower at the time the Lord confounded the language of the people. And then in 34 and 35, Jared is told that his language, therefore he did not confound the language of Jared. But it doesn't ever say here that Jared is speaking Adamic. I can't seem to find that here. But we do get a little bit in the Book of Mormon there.
Well, guys, this has been wonderful. I wanted to get to Abraham today, but we're just not going to be able to. So, listeners, we're going to reconvene here in a couple of weeks, and we'll just do the whole Abraham cycle as much as we can, and certainly be focusing on the most problematic area. I know that at least will come up, and it gets a lot of emphasis in Mormonism, and that'll be the binding of Isaac and the whole sacrifice and everything that happens with that. So we'll definitely cover that next time. So, guys, I'll just say thank you so much for taking us through Canaan and all that good stuff and the Tower of Babel and just some other interesting sidebar material here. So really appreciate you guys joining me today.
Thank you, Dan.
Dan.
And yes, and Tom and Brian, this, I really look forward to our conversations and for this chance to share and to be edified and learn from all three of you. So thank you.
It's marvelous to be on such a panel. I come away with new insights every time we do this.
Me too. Yeah, absolutely.
Me too. I'm freaking out with fun thoughts from you guys. So thank you so much. And you know, I'm just so impressed with you guys. And you're just like, well, that reminds me of Isaiah 14 verses 13 and 14, and I go to Exodus and stuff like that. And, you know, and I it's just amazing what you guys have studied and what you've internalized.
Our audience, we paid you to say that.
Not even. It just shows that you know, work really. really, really yields things, and you guys have taken it deep into your, you know, it's part of the narrative of your life now that you play with these scriptures in such a deep and powerful way, and I just learn a lot from you guys. So appreciate that. I know our listeners do too. This is, I get lots of good comments on this series. So the Genesis Dream Team, thank you guys. And listeners, please come and share whatever you'd like on anything that we've covered today. Send us your hopes and dreams for what we'll do when we get to Abraham. That might be a nice thing. Like I say, we'll convene again in 2 weeks with this panel and get that rolling. While you're at the website, feel free, please donate. Keep Mormon Matters going. Allow me to keep carving out the time that I'm able to for doing this show. And I just appreciate the great support I do get. Good night, guys. Thanks. Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
All is well.